Welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations and its Africa in Transition podcast. My name is John Campbell, and I'm here with Nnamdi Obasi, Nigeria Senior Advisor at the International Crisis Group, and Hans Hoengoop, Cameroon Analyst with the International Crisis Group. They are accompanied by E.J. Hoogendoorn from the Crisis Group's Washington office. Today, we will be discussing Boko Haram and the humanitarian crisis in the north of Nigeria and in Cameroon, based around Lake Chad. A list of Crisis Group's recent reports are relevant to this conversation, and I believe they are all available online. The titles which I have found particularly helpful are Nigeria, Women and the Boko Haram Insurgency, Cameroon, Confronting Boko Haram, Watchmen of Lake Chad, Vigilante Groups Fighting Boko Haram. Gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank you for joining us today. Like many other people, I deeply admire the work that you do. Let's start with Boko Haram. Nnamdi, what do you think gave rise to the group in northeastern Nigeria? And Hans, could you speak as to how the group spread to the Cameroons?
Hi. Thank you very much, Ambassador Campbell. It's an honor to be at your Council on Foreign Relations and also to be discussing a subject on which we have been very much engaged and we've increasingly trying to get a firm grip on. The genesis of Boko Haram dates back, you know, way back. But it's not a single cause that has led to this. It's a combination of several factors. It's an environment in which the indicators, economic and social and so on, had put people in a state of hopelessness and desperation, and one in which became very vulnerable to extremist ideologies and just about anyone who wanted to take advantage of the situation. And in that context, first of all, there were an extremist group that tried to recruit people to try to change that order, if you like, not started as a reformist group, sort of disenchanted with the situation that was existing at the time, but then over time evolved into a much hardline, a much harder position. But at the same time, there were also the involvement of political leaders in the region that tried to manipulate religion as an instrument of, you know, gaining greater political capital. And all of this worked together then to create a situation where you had a group that was in conflict with the state, and the reaction of the state enraged passions a lot more within the group and then drove it to a more extremist position.
So a context of impoverishment, general impoverishment.
Yes.
Combined with political manipulation of religious sentiment.
Right.
Added to that is the mishandling of the situation by the security services.
Absolutely.
How important do you think the religious dimension is?
It is important to the extent that it is a fundamental element in the evolution of the movement.
But a fundamental element,
yes,
so very important thing.
Yes, it's a very important element in the origins of the movement. But it probably wouldn't have assumed the dimensions it has assumed if it didn't have the environment in which it grew, and if the state did not respond to it the way it responded to it. I mean, in other parts of the country, we also have small groups that are, a bit to the extreme in their positions, but they haven't turned violent. And if properly handled, they could be kept under check. It's the particular circumstance in which the Boko Haram evolved in the northeast of the country and the way the state reacted to that evolution that then escalated the conflict.
One of the things I worry about was the military killing of Shia in Zaria about a year or so ago, and whether or not that could follow much the same pattern. Thus far it has not, but it's something I think we all have to be concerned about.
Yes, everyone is concerned about it. As a matter of fact, 2 months ago, a group in Borno State, the Borno Elders Forum, sent a message formally to President Buhari in which they said, unfortunately, we are seeing in Kaduna State a repeat of the mistake that was made in the Northeast. It hasn't quite evolved in that direction, and it may not. Of course, the circumstances are different, but there is always a risk, and that has to be very carefully watched.
And in the Cameroon.
Thank you very much. I am very honored to contribute to this discussion. Far enough, Cameroon, where Boko Haram is operating, shares some structural vulnerabilities with Northeast Nigeria. And Boko Haram exploited these vulnerabilities to gradually penetrate and rise from since 2009 up to 2013 with turning these networks that they were building in a violent insurgency at the beginning of 2014. What do I mean by vulnerabilities? Among the 10 regions in Cameroon is the worst in terms of economic indicators. One that strikes me is that at the national level, the rate of poverty is 37%, when before the crisis, in the far north, it was 75%.
37% nationwide, 75% in the north,
And
so dramatically poorer than the rest of the country.
And much more in the border town where we can reach 85%, even before the rise of Boko Haram. So you can also look at many types of indicators, the numbers of health centers infrastructure, the level of illiteracy, the fact that, for example, the border town are completely ideologically and linguistically linked to Northeast Nigeria and not to the Cameroon. For example, when you are going in the Logone Shari department, for example, precisely, which is on the top ahead of the far north, very few people there can speak English, French, or even Fufuldi, which is the lingua franca in the northern Cameroon in general, spread by Fulani.
Now, help me. It's the same people on both sides of the border. Same people.
Absolutely.
Similar social indicators.
And
the border is essentially a European creation.
Absolutely. There is no concept of... we should go further beyond the concept of porosity of the border. It's just a border zone.
It just doesn't mean anything.
The same villages. When you take, for example, in the Mayo-Sava department, Amshide at Banki, they are the same village. In the Logon Eshari department, Gamba Rungala and Fotokol in Cameroon are the same village. For all these reasons, for Boko Haram has gradually built connection and networks through socioeconomic incentives in the majority of cases, offering to young people who are unemployed motorbikes, a stipend or a salary for a certain time in case they join the movement, proposing them to offering them a wife, for example. That in some in some cases they have realized by kidnapping hundreds of young women that they have offered as wife to the best fighters as reward. All these incentives put together have contributed to the recruitment of 4,000 of active members in Cameroon in this period.
That's interesting. Your estimate is that there are 4,000
active fighters
In northern Cameroon.
In northern Cameroon. How many have been killed since the insurgency? Difficult to know. We know 1,000 or a little bit less have been arrested by Cameroonian security forces and are detained in Mara prison principally. How many are still within the insurgency? No one has a very clear idea, but the leading driving recruitment factor was the socioeconomic incentive. Then you have, of course, the ideological factor that has played also an important role. Not the lead one, but an important. Boko Haram, through the mixing of ideology of jihad, through the mixing of telling to the young people that we will rebuild the former Kanem-Bornu Empire, and then the Kanuri will become again a great tribe and a great kingdom. Mixing all that together with anti-Western feelings, have been able to recruit important people within the organization.
The government in Yaoundé is perceived as unsympathetic to the North?
There is a slight difference between the degree of misperception of the government, of both government in Nigeria and Cameroon. I do think in Nigeria, the government is much more worse perceived by the northern.
Interesting. Worse perceived.
Yeah. I mean,
in the north.
Maybe Nigeria, Namdi can correct my analysis, but I think there is...
Well, but that's an extremely interesting point, because the general perception that I have, and I think many Americans have, is that the government of Nigeria, for all of its faults, is still on a positive democratic trajectory with the credible elections and the fact that the opposition came to power. Mm. Whereas, in fact, the government in Yaounde has been there now for how many years doesn't approach the sort of democratic norms to the same extent that the government in Abuja.
Yeah.
But you are saying that amongst the peoples on either side of this border, those on the Nigerian side are more disaffected from the government.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
it's interesting.
Yeah, I think I even think one of our conclusion when researching is if Boko Haram had not indiscriminately killed Muslim and everyone, and if they have. If they were not the remaining, even if it is very less and very little, the remaining legitimacy of the state, without that, this insurgency in Cameroon could have turned in something much more bigger, much more dangerous for the stability of the state.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, if I may add just real quickly, because I have been involved in this for some time as well, I think for, you know, for an American listener, it's really difficult to explain how corrupt and nepotistic the system of governance in Nigeria can be. And so I think one of the things that people fail to realize is that Muhammad Yusuf, the putative founder of Boko Haram, he became a very, very popular person in the northeast of Nigeria because he spoke out very, very eloquently against these corrupt practices of the state governors, who he identified as being products of a Western form of governance, which is why his call to reject Western governance and Western education, i.e. Boko Haram, Boko being Western books and education, Haram obviously being prohibiting that, was very, very popular. And essentially, you know, he couched himself as a reformer and was very, very popular again. And it really was kind of the reaction of the state, which included this massive crackdown in 2009 in which he and some of his other officials were extrajudicially executed.
About 800 of them.
Basically, you know, precipitated this insurgency that then spun out of control. And essentially, you know, we are now stuck with that that consequence. I'm sorry, and I should say again, this is also where the ideology comes through. Essentially, Boko Haram made this argument, which on its face was very attractive to many people in the Northeast, which was that if only we had righteous, well-believing Muslim leaders, then many of the ills of society that we are currently facing would be essentially eliminated, because most of the problems that people are facing are perceived to be problems of governance and mismanagement and corruption.
Yeah.
But now, gentlemen, if we take what we have been saying, this means the roots of Boko Haram are very, very deep.
Absolutely.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah, very deep. Yeah. The response to Boko Haram tends to be, the official response to it, tends to be military. I mean, what do we read about? We read about how the Nigerian military has killed X number of Boko Haram fighters, secured the release of a number of kidnapped victims, has driven Boko Haram out of the territory that it once occupied. Now, is this the right way to proceed? And if it is, what kind of coordination do we see between the Cameroonian and Nigerian authorities?
I would say it's the military operation, security operations, constitute one of mm-hmm. the elements of the state response. Mm-hmm. The problem is to rely on that element as the sole element of response. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Boko Haram, having become, you know, a fighting force, an insurgency, I mean, it was inevitable that the state would also step up its response. So it's understandable that military operations have been conducted and are continuing against Boko Haram. Our worry is that this now obscures the more fundamental roots of this insurgency.
I quite agree.
And that in concentrating only on that military option, we have lost sight of those roots. And we have consistently argued in our reports, crisis group reports, mm-hmm. of the need to, you know, get back to those other issues, the economic issues, the social issues, the governance issues, the environmental issues, a whole basket of issues that, mm-hmm. you know, contributed to this. Mm-hmm. There's some indication of a possible, you know, shifts of strategy to incorporate those other elements, but we don't see it moving as fast as it should be. And in particular, given that Boko Haram has been driven considerably back, they've lost most of the territory, we would have expected a vigorous step up of those other elements of the response in order to recover state's legitimacy and render Boko Haram unpopular. But it's not moving fast yet.
What do we say? 2 million internally displaced persons in northeastern Nigeria.
200,000 in Cameroon.
But still, it's a huge number.
Yeah. Yes.
Given the population of Cameroon is small.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. Well, but the situation is much worse than that, right? So it's not just the internally displaced. I mean, the insurgency has decimated the regional economy.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Right now, according to the best figures that we have seen, something on the order of 11 million people in the region are at risk or food insecure. The response that's required is massive. And, of course, part of the problem is that most of the states in the region, particularly Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, lack the resources to respond adequately, which is one of the reasons, of course, that we had this Oslo conference last week, in which there was an attempt by international actors to generate more resources to respond to this threat. This is, you know, one of the problems that we are facing is that the response that's required is, or what is a necessary response, is this coordinated response. But many of the states also lack the resources and oftentimes also the capacity to do that adequately.
I absolutely agree with the point stressed by Namdi. In Cameroon too, there has been a narrow approach of the response against Boko Haram by the government. There has been a quite efficient military response on a strictly military point of the government, on which the Comorian government is even proud of this military response.
The Cameroons has an elite military
absolutely
group
called the Rapid Intervention Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that has helped to inflict deep casualties against Boko Haram and to deny Boko Haram to control for a long term villages in Cameroon or towns in Cameroon. So on that point, the response has been quite good. But up to now, matters related to humanitarian fallout of the conflict or the socioeconomic consequences of this conflict also link to the response of the government, because there has been some economic activities that have been banned by the government, like motorbikes, like fishing trades,
yes,
like the closure of the borders, and hundreds of thousands of people already vulnerable were relying on these activities. And since 3 years, they are just jobless. So
they can't farm, they can't fish, they
can't
trade.
Absolutely, absolutely. So a narrow response, in somehow efficient on the military point, but that need to be wider, and some economic bans of the government need to be progressively lifted in order to help the region, the people of the region, to go back to their former activities.
Does crisis group use the word famine to describe what's going on in northeastern Nigeria?
Not on a broad scale.
Not on a broad scale.
Yeah, but there are communities across the region.
So pockets.
Pockets of very dire situations as far as food security is concerned. The economy of the region, as EJ said, was completely devastated.
Mm-hmm.
Large sections of the populace moved out from rural areas into Maiduguri town and other major towns in the state. In some parts of the state, there's not been agriculture for 3 years running. And as Hans was saying, the other elements of trade and fishing and so on, even the supply of fuel, motor fuel, telecommunications in some areas, you know, everything was completely degraded or just, you know, embargoed. So it's in a very difficult situation, and that's why some of the communities need help desperately. Otherwise, the situation will get worse.
Just one simple example. If I take the case of the Far North region in Cameroon, which is the most populated region of Cameroon. Cameroon has got roughly 23 million of people. The Far North is 4 million. According to the estimation of the various UN agencies, 1 million, so a quarter of the local population, are severely food insecure. And 1.6 million need an urgent humanitarian assistance. This is quite a big number. But for the time being, priority of the government seems to be focus, most importantly on the military, not on this point, while the international community response for the time being has been more focused on the 60,000 Nigerian refugees, but have not addressed the problem of the IDPs, of the community hosting them, and the wider population which need assistance.
I think this is... And I'm sorry, if you could also speak for a moment about the shifting of humanitarian assistance from the east to the north.
Absolutely, absolutely. We usually talk about the Far North province, but you have also the eastern region of Cameroon, where you have 260,000 Central African refugees.
That's right.
The problem is focusing the attention only on the humanitarian assistance cannot be a sustainable solution. We have seen UN agencies, international NGOs, arrive in the eastern region 4 years ago. Now they are tired. There is a kind of fatigue of the help, and they are closing their agencies. Why, on the contrary, the number of refugees is growing? We fear that this can happen in the Lake Chad Basin if we only focus the attention on the humanitarian assistance rather than providing people skills and possibility of a sustainable ownership of the development and be autonomous. Because in 5 years, maybe the donors will say, we have heard a lot about Boko Haram.
So that Cameroon faces two challenges, refugees in the east from the Central African Republic, refugees from Boko Haram, Nigerian refugees from Boko Haram. But because they're refugees and there's an international structure to respond to them, there is a response, but not to internally displaced persons because they're outside the international regime. So where we are thus far, then, is a major security problem, a major humanitarian problem.
Yes.
They're interlinked. It's hard to see how you can proceed with one without the other. How do you deliver humanitarian aid in northeastern Nigeria where there is no security, or in northern, or northern Cameroon? Now, I'd be interested in what you have to say about an issue that concerns me over the long term, and that is the use of vigilantes in the Northeast. So far as I can tell, the vigilantes that have been assisting the security forces are not under the discipline of the security forces. They're not under the control of the security forces. Elsewhere in Africa, we have seen that the long-term consequences of vigilante activity can be a kind of, what's the word I want, can be a kind of gangsterism. They can slide over into criminal activity. They become very difficult to control. Do you have any reaction?
Yes, I would want to elaborate a little on the situation and also as it has changed over time.
Good.
At the initial stages, they evolved as more or less mobs that went after mm-hmm. Boko Haram and...
Or alleged Boko Haram.
Alleged Boko Haram, yeah. Suspected Boko Haram. And yeah. Well, some of them, of course, were definitely Boko Haram because this was a community in which they had, you know, grown up and they knew them mm-hmm. very well and they knew what they had done. And mm-hmm. in some cases, in fact, in Maiduguri at the time, you could see them riding on motorbikes and motorcycles with their rifles and, you know, they're going to kill somebody. And then shortly after that, you hear gunshots and thereafter you know that somebody has been killed and you know the people who killed him. So it wasn't a hidden thing. Some of them mm-hmm. knew the Boko Haram very well and went after them. Others went after suspected Boko Haram. Others went after, you know, people suspected of collaborating with Boko Haram, all kinds of things. But they had to do something at the time because they were under the pressure from Boko Haram's killing on one side and military, you know, pressure on the other side. So initially, there was no control at all. They were just mobs going after Boko Haram, suspected Boko Haram targets. But then over time, that has, you know, changed. First of all, the military, seeing their utility at that point, began to collaborate with them, you know, draw them closer and organized them in Maiduguri at the time along the same formations as the military. The military, for instance, was, you know, configured in 10 sectors around Maiduguri. And the civilian vigilante, the civilian JTF, was then formed along those lines, 10 sectors, with commanders of the sectors and so on. At that early stage also, there was, you know, as I said, little control. And the military, yes, they were useful to the military, but the military led them to their own devices to do a number of things. But as time went on, when the state now brought them under its
umbrella
and oversight, mm-hmm. they became more under real control because the state now had to bear responsibility for whatever they did or did not do. Now, some of them were now trained by the by the state. About 1,850 of them were given, you know, training under a state program. About 800 out of that were given basic military training. There's a large number of others, by their own figure, about 26,000, that, you know, haven't benefited from that kind of training. So the 1,850 that were trained by the state paid allowances every month.
So they're regularized.
Yes, they're regularized. They have a uniform. They have identity cards.
And a salary.
And salary. Mm-hmm. An allowance, as they call it. It's not a big amount of money, but something every month that they can look forward to, and they get it. And then the state provided logistics, 40 Hilux Toyota Hilux trucks with which they could get around, and they gave them uniform, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, to ensure that they didn't have anybody under 18 anymore, as against the case in the past when they had underage mm-hmm. Children, you know, fighting with them. So there's been a movement from that initial stage, you know, up till this point. But there is not, and this is the point of our worry, that there is no clarity about what to do going forward. Is this going to be retained as a permanent force? A lot of people in Maiduguri and the Northeast broadly believe that the emergence of this group was because there was a security gap between mm-hmm. the state's mm-hmm. security system and the grassroots, the situation mm-hmm. on ground, and they needed something that would connect those two.
Yes.
And this group has provided that connection. But then the question is, what do you do to this group in the long term?
Do you incorporate them into the army?
The army and police and so on, exactly. Or do you leave them as, you know, a different group entirely? Should they be armed because they are facing Boko Haram threats, you know, from Boko Haram members who are armed? Or should they not be armed and then vulnerable to Boko Haram? If they remain armed, doesn't that, you know, constitute a threat to the communities in which they are supposed to be providing some policing functions? And under whose control should they be? Should it be a state agency or a federal mm-hmm. agency? Of course, a state agency, there are very serious concerns about, you know, the possible abuse of this kind of structure for political purposes.
Absolutely.
And so on and so forth. So a discussion is going on, and that's the essence of the report that we put out, trying to promote that discussion. It's not going on enough in Nigeria, as in fact it is in international community and humanitarian organizations. But we think our report wanted to contribute to that discussion and say, clearly, what do you do going forward? Mm-hmm. We spoke with a lot of them during our research in October and November last year in the Northeast, and there were all kinds of categories. Some said they were students previously, mm-hmm. and they would want assistance to go back to school. Some were in business and they needed assistance to restart their businesses. Some have no skills whatsoever.
Yes.
They need some skill training and, you know, a way forward. Some are qualified for recruitment into the military. Most are not, and so on and so forth. But, you know, up till now. But basically, there's a strong sense of entitlement among them, a feeling that they've made sacrifices, yes, and they've, you know, shown real guts in fighting Boko Haram on behalf of the state, and therefore that they deserve some compensation from the state. And especially when they look at the Niger Delta and look at the amnesty program in, yes, the Niger Delta, and they say they can see that these were people who were rewarded for militancy against the state, then they argue that, well, they even deserve to be treated better because they fought on behalf of the state.
Exactly. Are there equivalent groups in Cameroon?
Yes, you have about 16,000 members of the vigilante group in Cameroon. It is a long culture in the country. I mean, even in the 60s, the 90s, the early 30s.
Sometimes called hunters?
It's not necessarily the case. You have been some brotherhoods of hunters in Cameroon, in Logone Shari Department particularly. But there is a culture of local self-defense group.
I see. It's broader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the north and in the south. Basically, given the weak stage of the state and the weak security services, the inability of the state security services to provide security, mm-hmm, across the entire country. Legally, there has been a regional instruction signed by the governor of the FANOF in 2014 to much more institutionalize this vigilante group. And I do think there has been less abuses committed by the vigilante group Cameroon compared to Nigeria, for example. And they are much more tight and controlled by the security forces, and whether it is the regular army or the elite unit, the, mm-hmm, rapid intervention brigade. And of course, even at the level of the presidency, there are concerns and worries of what they will become in the post-conflict management approach. And I was told when discussing with people from the government and from the regional administration, also in the FANOF, that there has been an instruction to register properly each of them. But now, based on the research that we have conducted, that from October 2016 to January 2017, most do not necessarily want to be incorporated in the army. Some used to be traders doing small businesses, sure, with Nigeria, mm-hmm, and they think they used to earn financially much more than what a Cameroonian soldier earned. So they are much more interested in the ideas of reopening the border, maybe giving them a kind of small stipend or fund that they can restart their former business. But definitely there is also
some... A restore to normality.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But there are also some who want to be incorporated in the police or within the military, the armed force.
Just to add a little more, Ambassador.
Yes.
On the role of hunters in the northeast, mm-hmm, of Nigeria. In Borno State, the civilian JTF is largely an urban-based or town-based group of young people who went after Boko Haram. Sometimes traditional hunters, and there's a long hunting tradition in, yes, that environment, yes, some of them joined the civilian JTF. Mm-hmm. Some members of what an organization called the Vigilante Group of Nigeria, which is trying to establish itself as a formal vigilante organization nationwide, some of them joined the civilian JTF, so it's a mixture of all that three. But when you move to Adamawa State, south of Borno State, also in the northeast along the border with Cameroon, it's a slightly different situation. Here we have the push against Boko Haram by non-military elements was largely by traditional hunters, and there were thousands and of them. Now, in that region, there is not that demand for long-term compensation or engagement by the government. They were mobilized by the elite at that time to respond to an immediate threat. And thereafter, many of them are content to go back to their old occupations and continue with their life, but they also expect some reward from the government, you know, in order to go back and do that.
So nuance then. Vigilantes in Borno, heavily urban. In Adamawa, more rural-based. In Adamawa, closely tied to the traditional establishment. In the north, less so.
Yes.
In the north, more of a concern about getting compensation from the state for what they have done.
Yes.
Have I got that right?
Right. And in the north, in Borno State, the likelihood of their perpetuating themselves as a vigilante organization
is stronger
as against in Adamawa State, where they would be glad to just get a payoff from the state and then go back to their original occupations.
And to add just really quickly, the vigilantes for the North are also recruiting from the same pool of unemployed youth that have traditionally, in the Nigerian context, been used to perpetrate political violence in and around election campaigns. Hence, again, our concerns that if these groups are not controlled or regularized in a certain way, that they could become, again, the private armies for political entrepreneurs or other people who were trying to create mayhem for their own particular political purposes.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before you leave, do you have any last thoughts as to what the international community should be doing? You're going to be asked this around town.
Yes. I think, we think from our reports that there are a few key things that ought to be done. First, security, because unless you have a secure environment, you can't even expand, humanitarian operations within the region. So support the countries in the region to provide greater security to civilian populations, to the humanitarian organizations that are on ground. And that includes, importantly, strengthening the regional military force, the multinational joint task force, strengthening it to deliver better on security in the region, but also encouraging greater and sustained cooperation between the militaries and other security organizations in all the four countries. In other words, to encourage a perception of this as a regional security challenge that must be addressed regionally rather than the present situation where, well, there's some collaboration, but there's a need for a lot more. The countries are still, in a sense, operating individually. The second point is the humanitarian operation. It's clear that it's been under-resourced in the last year. The funding was just about 53% of what was needed by the UN system and other major humanitarian organizations. It's, a welcome development that we had the conference in Oslo last week. But then the pledges that were made still fall less than the $1.5 billion that the UN system and major agencies need to respond effectively this year. So we think the international community must step up the humanitarian funding. And then thirdly, to look at this as an issue that requires not just emergency response, but longer-term engagement and longer-term planning. We talked about an environment in which Boko Haram, evolved. And unless you change that environment, if we provide only humanitarian assistance for 1 year, 2 years, and then go away, we will leave the region vulnerable to the same kinds of problems and even worse in future. So beyond immediate humanitarian assistance, the international community must think of longer-term engagement with the structural vulnerabilities that led to this in the first place.
I completely share the structure of recommendation of my colleague. Regarding the security point, which is the first priority, I will just emphasizing by saying, stressing the need for the regional government to tackle the issue of Boko Haram defectors.
Regional government.
I mean, by regional government, I mean Cameroon.
Oh, you mean the countries of the region.
Countries, yes. Of the region. To tackle the issue of defectors and designing balanced policies that can encourage the thousands of people inside Boko Haram that could be interested by leaving the government. And we know that there are clear indications showing many of them now want to abandon the movement. There are some who have surrendered in Chad, others have surrendered in Niger. By assuring some of them that they will not be immediately killed by the armed force if they quit the movement, that can be helpful in the terms of isolating the few hardliners that are remaining inside.
So, security, humanitarian, and reintegration.
Yes. Well, longer-term development, longer-term engagement in development, and then reintegration.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
And I'm sorry, and just to add it to complicate these things, I think that one of the arguments we're trying to make, which is quite hard to make vis-a-vis governments, is that there is a real need for foreign ministries and aid agencies to get out of country silos and to look at the Lake Chad Basin in a regional way, mm-hmm. in large part because the Lake Chad Basin is really a regional economic environment in mm-hmm. which people traded regularly across borders. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if they respond only to the needs of Nigeria or only to the needs of Cameroon or only to the needs of Chad and only to the needs of Niger, that is going to be much less than it could be if they were joined up and addressed as a single unit.
That's the last word.